This episode of the podcast is sponsored by a friend from Borough Park, Lahaglul Tayru Lahadira. If anyone would like to sponsor an episode of the podcast or to support the podcast, and I know I've mentioned this in the past, but I want to mention it again here. I'm looking into various services and equipment, but you know, some asked me, what are you talking about? So something like Riverside.fm and some other things. So that costs. So if anyone is able or willing to help support the podcast, I appreciate it. I'll put a link in the show's notes for where you can go through the Storm Shadow website, which is linked through PayPal, or you can email me for Zelle, QuickPay, or anything else. If, again, if you're able to or willing to help support and to help the podcast. Also, I want to just reiterate again, thank you to everyone who rated and reviewed it and subscribed to the podcast on Spotify, on Apple, but Apple especially, if you could review it, besides for rating it. That is very much appreciated as well. And as always, any comments, questions, or feedback, please email me, svarimchatter@gmail.com. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Svarim Chatter podcast. On this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Rabbi Edward Reichman, MD, who is a professor of emergency medicine and professor of bioethics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And he's an attending physician in emergency medicine at Amat Ifyor Medical Center. And he recently was appointed the Rabbi Isaac and Bella Tendler Chair in Jewish Medical Ethics at YU. And we will be discussing his new book, which is called The Anatomy of Jewish Law, A Fresh Dissection of the Relationship Between Medicine, Medical History, and Rabbinic Literature, which is published or co-published by Magid, which is Koren Publishers, OU Press, and YU Press. So thank you, Rabbi Reichman, for joining me.
My absolute pleasure, Nachi. I am an avid listener of Storm Chatter, and it is a pleasure and supposed to join you.
Okay, so let's start off. Tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background.
I come from Wisconsin originally. My father, Elva Shalom, was a rabbi in Wisconsin for many years, and that's where I grew up. I went to high school. There was no high school to go to at that time when I was growing up, yeshiva high school. So I went to Skokie Yeshiva in Chicago for high school, went to Yeshiva Kotel after high school. Then I went to Yeshiva University, graduated Yeshiva University, then went on to medical school at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And after medical school, I did my residency and have done my training. My entire medical practice has been emergency medicine, but after medical school, I did my smicha at Yeshiva University at Yitzchak Elchanan, Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, and completed my smicha after roughly seven, eight years or so after I completed my my medical education. And I'm currently practicing emergency medicine and a professor of emergency medicine at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine.
Okay, so obviously you're a doctor and you have smicha, so the rabbi, kind of a real rabbi doctor, rabbi MD. So, but in the book, it's kind of what, you know, we'll discuss this much more, obviously, with how it's medicine and Torah together, mixed together with medical history. So how did you become interested in all of that? All those things together, so much so that you wrote this book, which for essays we'll talk about, you write. You have other things people may be familiar with, a lot of your posts on the Svarim blog. You have many posts over there and other that are not in the book. So where did this interest develop from?
So the interest of medical halacha developed in college because I knew I was applying to medical school. I was always interested in the practice of medicine, and I became interested in the halachic aspects of medicine. I had the schus of learning with some of the very prominent figures in the world of medical halacha. Rabbi Tendler, Zichrono Livracha, recently passed away. He was one of the giants in the world of medical halacha. Rabbi Bleich, Shlita, another one of the giants in medical halacha. So I developed an interest in medical halacha really in college. When I went to medical school, in my final year of medical school, I did an elective in medical history. At that time, my brother was living in London. And I thought it'd be interesting to do an elective in medical history. There's an institute called the Wellcome Institute for the History of Medicine, a very prominent medical history institute, has a magnificent library. And actually, the library was used by Rabbi Lord Emanuel Jacobowitz, who was one of the former chief rabbis of England, when he wrote his dissertation, which became one of the first modern books in Jewish medical ethics called Jewish Medical Ethics. And that when I was in the library there, the librarian said the last Orthodox Jew we'd seen here was Rabbi Jacobowitz some decades earlier. But it was then that I developed an interest and appreciation for history, for medical history. And I came to the realization that so many of these makoros that we are learning in the world of medical halacha are hundreds, if not thousands, of years old. And the understanding of medicine was vastly different from the understanding of medicine in the 20th and 21st century. And I began to realize that an interesting approach and an interesting contribution, which hasn't really been developed, is to appreciate some of these medical halachic sources in their historical context. And that's really what when I began this journey, which I've been developing over the last many years.
So talk a little bit more about that, which is what the book is about. Because like I said, the book, even though there's a lot of medical halacha, it's not a book, safer of medical halacha. That's not exactly what it is. Like you say, it's the medical halacha with the history and in the historical context. So explain a little bit more what the book is about and why you decided to write an entire book on this, which is about, just flipping through, over 500 pages.
Right. So thank you for pointing that out, Nachi. One thing, it is not a standard or classic book in medical halacha. So for those of you who are looking for that, this is not what you're looking for. Those books, and there are many extraordinary books and many, many people contributing to that field. Fred Rosner, whom I studied with in my residency, he was my chief of medicine, actually, when I did my medical training. And one of my great mentors has written extensively on that. Rabbi Tendler, we mentioned, Rabbi Bleich in the English language, Avram Steinberg, Mordechai Halpern, Avram Avram. Those are people who've written tremendously in that field. That is a conventional, standard, classic medical halacha. This book takes a different focus. It really takes medical halachic literature, deals with medical halachic issues, many of the same medical halachic issues, in fact, but focuses on a different perspective, puts them in their historical context. So this book is divided into a number of different sections. It's divided into a section on anatomy. It's divided into a section on therapeutics. It's divided into a section on fertility and reproduction. And I didn't set out years ago to write a book like this. I really, over the course of many years, wrote essays which covered from beginning of life to end of life on many different topics that interested me, and sort of evolved into the book that you see before you. And I reworked some of these essays and synthesized them and homogenized them. And realize that they largely reflect all the same concept and the same notion, really, of the importance of historical perspective to best appreciate these halachic sources. And some of the, as I set out a little bit in the introduction to the work, there are a number of different ways in which a historical understanding can really be useful. So, for example, just understanding the text itself. Poskim throughout the centuries quote medical authorities. Now, when a posek today quotes a medical authority, they're usually quoting a New England Journal of Medicine, maybe, or they're quoting they spoke to a physician or they consulted physicians. They're usually not mentioning necessarily the references that they're talking about. And there's a reason for that, because today the references are textbooks, which are a composite of hundreds of authors, or from medical journals and things like that. But in the pre-modern era, the people who were writing in medicine were individuals, authorities, which Postman would quote. For many, many hundreds of years, they were quoting the same people. So, for example, it's not uncommon to see, Hippocrates quoted in a posek, or Galen quoted in a posek. Or, for example, there is a very famous physician from the 9th, 10th century whose works were common knowledge for all people trained in medicine. His name was Ibn Sina, or Avicenna, and he was a Persian physician. And if you don't know who Ibn Sina is, you're gonna go on Bar Ilan database and try and find the Sefer written by Ibn Sina. You know, so it helps you understand just simply, you know, who the posthume are referring to. It also helps you understand concepts. So today we take a lot of concepts for granted in terms of basics in anatomy, basics in physiology. But the people writing in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance had very different understandings of anatomy, very different understandings of physiology. You know, for example, the Ramban mentions a notion in when Yaakov found out that Yosef was still alive. The Torah says "Vayafag libo," that and the Ramban explains that. The Ramban, by the way, was a physician. People don't realize the Ramban was a physician. People know the Ramban was a physician. They don't know the Ramban was a physician. The Rashba says in a number of places that the Ramban was a physician. So the Ramban says, like, what does it mean by a fugly bow? It means that that he actually passed out. He had, in medicine, what we would call a syncopal episode, and his heart expanded. And he talks about the term chom hativi, his innate heat. What does the Ramban mean by chom hativi? So if you're in the 20th, 21st century, you're reading this Ramban, you don't know what he's talking about. But if you were a contemporary of the Ramban and you studied medicine at that time, that was a basic understanding of physiology, not just in the halachic world, in the secular world. They thought that the heart contained an innate heat, which like a fire, like a furnace, which created heat in the body. And based on this physiological principle, he explained that Tehi Ruach Yaakov doesn't mean that his nevuah came back, like Rashi quoting the Medrash, but actually his breath came back, that he was resuscitated, physiologically resuscitated. So this is just one example, but appreciation and understanding of these kinds of concepts can enlighten your understanding and clarify pshat in things which you wouldn't otherwise understand.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was actually just reading Professor Oded Israeli's new biography of the Ramban, and he had a whole discussion on that. That mentions that he was a doctor, a physician. And you mentioned that you see a lot of these. If you look at a lot of the Sifrei Rishonim, you'll still see this. I mean, you mentioned Shvili Amuna here at least one time that I saw. Meir ibn al-Dabi, I know I've seen his Sefer is full of references to Galen and to Hippocrates and to others. And, like, you know, they're always mentioning Aristotle and Avicenna. They're always throwing out everything.
Yeah, let me jump in here. It's funny you mentioned the Shvili Amuna. I had a very fascinating Ashkacha story with the Shvili Amuna of Ibn al-Dabi, Meir ibn al-Dabi. So to give you an idea, by the way, of how prevalent the quoting the works of Galen and Hippocrates was, if you look at the Cairo Geniza, there are many medical fragments in the Cairo Geniza that are written in the Hebrew language or Judeo-Arabic, and they are translations of Hippocrates and Galen and Aristotle. And the Rambam, by the way, wrote a Perush on Hippocrates, literally who lived 1,700 years earlier. He wrote a Perush on Hippocrates. And the Shvili Amuna, you know, gathered a lot of the medical information at that time. He was the go-to person. And the fascinating Hashgacha story I'll share with you, I went to the Cairo Geniza in Cambridge, and I met with a man named Haskell Isaacs, who's since passed away. He was an Iraqi physician who knew Arabic and Judeo-Arabic. And he wasn't a firm guy. He wasn't a religious guy. And he showed me, I said, show me the Jewish aspects of the medical Geniza. His job was to collect the medical Geniza. So he showed me, translations of Galen, translation of Hippocrates. He said, show me something religious. Show me something, you know, Jewish. So he showed me a sefer that talked about Tvila and Rechitza. And he said, this is the most religious thing that I found. And he said, I don't know where it comes from. I haven't identified this fragment yet. So I took a note of it, and then I was on my way. This was from England. I went to Eretz Yisrael to learn there. And I stopped in the first farm shop I went to in Meir Sharim. I said, what medical books do you have? What do you have on medicine? So they pulled out two svarim at that time. He pulled out Masa Tuvia, which was written by Tuvia Rofe, which I think, Dachi, you know, the famous physician from the University of Padua, published in the early 1700s in Venice. And the second sefer he gives me is Shvili Amuna, which was just recently republished. I think it was in the early 1990s at that time. And this Ma'aseh Tuvia was also republished again at that time. So I start opening up this Shvili Emuna, and I see there's a whole chapter on Rechitza and Tvila. And I look and I said, this is very familiar. I just came across this very recently. And at that time, things weren't digitized yet, but they were on microfilm in the National Library of Israel. So I went to the National Library of Israel. I found that exact fragment from the Cairo Geniza that I had seen. And I matched it up. It turns out that previously unidentified fragment was actually from the Shvili Emuna.
So for those that aren't familiar, Shvili Emuna, he says he's, I think, a grandson of the Rush. He was at the end of the Tekuvos Rishayim. And it's a very interesting sefer. Actually, I was working on the Teres Chaim, and he quotes a Shvili Emuna, and that's where I went down this rabbit hole with Galen, and I ended up there in a Shvili Emuna. There's actually, so as if there's two new editions, actually, oddly enough, there's like a simple edition with like Nikudas, and someone did an edition with like a light pirish, and then someone else did one like in Yeshiva's Mir. Someone did like half of the vit with like more extensive footnotes. I think he says there's been like 18 editions. I could be totally off on that, but at least 10. And it's like been redone many times, and now it's not so much a famous sefer. It's a really interesting sefer. So yeah, you do talk about that here. So I just one other thing to go back to what we were talking about is something interesting. That you said it specifically, and I don't remember where in the book, but you kind of repeat this a bunch of times where it says you're trying to place responses, shalos tshuvos, and psak in its relevant medical historical context because you wrote halacha is immutable, but the medical and scientific theories are constantly changing. Now, this is kind of what you were just saying before, but I said, like, you know, you put it down. I think that was your exact wording at some point in the book. That's you wrote.
Right. That's a really important theme that you highlight, Nachi. It's the halachic principles, the halachic methodology has remained constant for thousands of years. But the application of that methodology is going to change based on the understanding of medicine and science. And medicine and science has evolved tremendously, even in our own short lifetimes. But over the course of thousands of years, since the giving of the Torah, it has evolved tremendously. And one needs to really understand, if you're talking about a posek from 500, 1,000 years ago, and you want to use that psak for a contemporary discussion, say, about the definition of death and the way they understood cardiac and respiratory physiology, then you have to understand what they knew about cardiac and respiratory physiology when the posek was writing that tshuva, or when Rashi was writing his perush on a Gemara. How do they understand the interrelationship of the heart and the lungs, for example, and the brain? So that's helpful in order to extrapolate from those sources to contemporary halachic issues.
Yeah, so we'll discuss various parts of the book. Obviously, it's a big book. We're not going to discuss all of it. So something that's actually 200 pages in, it's not right in the beginning, but I don't know, it should be in the beginning. I ask you why it's not in the beginning also, is you mentioned that you discussed the anatomy of halacha. And that's where you start out discussing halakha discussion of anatomy and about anatomy. So first of all, why wasn't that right away in the beginning? That's the first thing I want to ask you. And
good kasha. Good kasha. I guess you have to be born before you have anatomy. So I put the fertility and reproduction up front. But your point is well taken. The anatomy of halakha is the title. You know, perhaps I should have had some of the anatomy up front.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about that. We'll start there, and we'll go backwards to the fertility and the conception. We'll do that after.
Great.
Let's start with anatomy.
Sure. So the anatomy, there are a number of different aspects of anatomy that we discuss. One is the very detailing of the anatomy of the human body, which is discussed in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, by the way, that Mishnah of which I'm going to mention now of Ramach Evarim Eish Ba'odom is 248 Evarim. However, those Evarim are to be defined. However, an Evar is to be defined is a Mishnah in Olos, and everybody knows Ramach Evarim, and we say it in the Mishaberech Lachola. The question is, why does that even appear in the Mishnah? Why does that appear at all? Why are Chazal talking about that? The Chazal didn't write a medical book. So it's relevant in as much as it relates to Tumah V'Tahara, to purity and impurity. And one of the forms of tumas zoel, is being in this in an enclosure with a corpse, which is the major form of that conveys tuma. And halacha is that the majority of a corpse conveys tuma, either the majority of the height of a corpse or a majority of the number of limbs or avarim conveys tuma. So in order to know what conveys tuma, you have to know how many avarim there are. So there are 248 avarim, and so a simple majority of 125 of one body, of one goof, would convey, tuma soel. So the Mishnah actually is very specific. It tells exactly what those ramach avarim are. And the question is, how does that correlate with our modern understanding of anatomy? And the answer is, it's not such a simple and direct correlation. Many things do seem very clear, the long bones, the bones in the hand, the pelvis, but the ribs are, there's some discrepancies, the spinal cord, the vertebra, there are discrepancies. And it's interesting, the Gemara has a very remarkable passage, given the medical history. There's the Gemara in Bechoros, which talks about the students of Rabbi Shmuel, that there were shalak a zona, shalak shin lamed kuf. The question is, what does that mean? So they performed some kind of dissection on a zona, a female prostitute who was condemned to death by the king, or the queen in that case, and they did it. They performed the dissection in order to clarify the Mishnah in Olos, the ramach evarim, to see exactly what those ramach evarim were. And the Gemara concludes that they arrived at 252, not 258, or according to one gear, so 253. So the Gemara asks, how is it possible they got a different number than the Mishnah and Olah? So they answer that it was a female body that was being dissected. So that's why there is a discrepancy between those two. So what that tells you is that it's not exactly clear, because there is no difference in bones. If an aver means exclusively a bone, there is no difference in bones between a male and female skeleton. There's a difference in the curvature of the spine, the curvature of the pelvis, but there is no difference in the number of bones. So that's a sort of a challenge. And by the way, that Gemara is the source of the different Mishaberech Lecholim, the different bracha for the male and female chola, someone who's ill. If you say for the man, you say Ramach, he should have a speedy recovery to his 248 limbs and his 368 gidim. But if you say for a woman, some have the minhag to say a separate one, because the Gemara says the woman doesn't have 248. So there the text is L'chol Evareo, L'chol Gideh, that she should have her full shlema to all her limbs, because according to the Gemara, she doesn't have 248. So there have been people throughout the centuries that have tried to correlate them to modern anatomy. One who's creative, which you'll actually find referenced in the Kahati Mishnayos, is Yehuda Leib Katznelson, who was a Russian physician. And he wrote a book called Ramach Evarim, which, by the way, was published in Tuf, Resh Mem Ches. It was published in Ramach. I always wonder if he rushed to publication or if he delayed publication to get specifically to that Ramach. But he has a very creative theory that the shalak, shalku zona, that they boiled the body in the course of their dissection. And he claims the body was a female body roughly between the age of 16, 17 years old, where the bones are not completely fused. So the long bones, for example, are comprised of bony centers and bone on the ends, but there's cartilage in the middle. So what would normally be one long bone would actually be three bones if the body were boiled. So it's an interesting theory. I don't know the veracity of the theory. But to this very day, the exact definition of the Ramach Evarim and exact correlates to modern anatomy still remain somewhat of a mystery.
Okay, so you do another thing you discuss in this chapter, and once we're here, I guess we may as well discuss a little bit what you discussed in the chapter before going backwards. Now I'm out of order. So you discuss autopsy and dissecting a body, and as you you note here and later on the Tale of Two Stones, which is kind of this chapter again. It's just a little bit again later, so you can mention it here if you want, which is Yaakov Emden and the Nedib Yehuda B'chazka Landau. But you mention how this the Rishayim, the Rambam, Rabbi Yosef Karo, and Shulchan Aruch did not discuss this autopsy. It only comes up later, and you launch into a discussion of why that is. So, and if you want to.
Right, exactly. So Naki, it's not only enlightening the text, which a historical approach is relevant for, the actual substance of the text, but the context and the period in which these tshuvas were written. So historically, everybody who knows anything about autopsy or anatomical dissection, the starting point is the Nodav Yehuda, the very first tshuva in halachic literature to talk about anatomical dissection and autopsy is the tshuva of the Nodav Yehuda, who lived in the 1700s. So you have to step back for a moment and say, why is that? We have that reference in the Gemara, which is sort of a rare reference to that dissection. But the Rambam, who not only was a tremendous Baal Halacha, but it was himself a physician. You'd expect the Rambam in his Mishneh Torah to discuss anatomical dissection and the issues of Isser Anah and Nivul HaMeis and desecrating the body and the obligation to bury the body, et cetera, et cetera. The Shulchan Aruch covers from before life till after death. You'd expect the Shulchan Aruch to discuss anatomical dissection, especially if it was part of medical training. It would be obvious that they would be discussing this. So the reason they don't discuss it is because anatomical dissection was not an integral part of medical training. It only became part of medical training really in the 1500s and onwards. I mean, it was started maybe a little earlier than that, but the person who's credited as being the founder of modern anatomy is Andreas Vesalius. Andreas Vesalius was a professor of anatomy in the University of Padua. It is a picture from his classic work called The Fabric of the Human Body, which appears on the very cover of the book. And Andreas Vesalius was the first person to dissect systematically the body from A to Z, from head to toe. And on all those before him, including Hippocrates, including Galen, did not do a systemic dissection. And it's unclear why that was the case. It could be, especially later in history, that maybe the Catholic Church is responsible for that, for changing that. But whatever the case may be. So that's why it makes perfect sense. By the way, even Galen was a physician to the gladiators in the Roman Colosseum. So he learned a little cross-sectional anatomy, perhaps, from being a doctor to the gladiators. But everything he wrote was based on animals, largely based on animals, on apes, on other animals. So there were a lot of errors, and it took till Vesalius in the 1500s to correct that. So that's why you really don't have any discussion. It's really the Nodav Yehuda, which is much, much later, that you have really the first discussion of anatomical dissection, the first discussion of autopsy. And even the very medical case that was addressed by the Nodav Yehuda has historical relevance. The case that was presented to him was a case of someone who had a choli ha-even b'kiso, someone who was afflicted with an even b'kiso. What's an even b'kis? It sounds like a stone in some kind of pocket. So some people erroneously think it was gallstones, that it was a case of gallstones, which a patient died, and they asked the Nodav Yehuda if they could do an autopsy afterwards. But it's not. It's not a case of gallstones. Gallstones wasn't even operated on until 100 years after the Nodav Yehuda. It was a case of bladder stones, stones in the urinary bladder, which was a very, very common condition in that particular time. And even Rav Yaakov Emden, who was rough contemporary of Nodav Yehuda, he had a student who was a medical student at that time, Ginsberger, Binyamin Wolf Ginsberger, asked a shiloh of Rav Yaakov Emden about whether it's permissible for him to perform dissection of an animal on Shabbos, because they didn't have bodies for dissection at that time. So it was really only at that time that anatomical dissection became an integral part of medical training. And that student, by the way, fascinating historical parentheses, Binyamin Wolf Ginsberger, who asked the shiloh to Rav Yaakov Emden, and is published in Shilas Yavetz, I think it's Mem Aleph, wrote a dissertation to complete his medical training on biblical and Talmudic medicine in the 1700s as the very first Jew ever to attend a German university. And we still have a copy of that dissertation, which was written in Latin.
Yeah, as dissertations, I think, used to be written in at the time. So, okay, let's go backwards now. First of all, I mentioned that that chapter is like 20 to 30 pages, and you have the other chapter just on the two stones. So there's a lot more there. You go through a lot of historical sources. You have pretty big footnotes in that chapter. So there's a lot more there. Now, the first chapter, I think we should go back. Like you said, the first section, so this is actually what we just discussed was the second section, but the first section of the book, the fertility and reproduction. So really the first chapter, perhaps you want to discuss a little bit, was really interesting, which is the rabbinic conception of conception and exercise in fertility. A cute name, I guess, of the chapter. And then you have a couple of other ones there. I can, you know, perhaps want to discuss the first one, but I'll just mention you have the doctrine of the seven-chamber uterus, Parshas Tazria and childbirth, is there life after life, Medrash miracles in motherhood, which is Dina, the birth of Dina, the definition of maternity. Then you have the first halachic discussion of ovarian transplantation, uterine transplantation, and then you have shared biological paternity in rabbinic literature. So there's a whole bunch of things over there. Some of that's a little heavy. I don't know if we'll get into all of that right now.
But sure.
If you want to discuss some of that.
Sure. The rabbinic conception of conception, one of the really fertile areas of the relationship of medical history and rabbinic literature and halachic sources is the understanding of reproduction itself. So using as a foundation, even take, I suggest you just go through the beginning, go through the Rishonim on Parshas Ki Tazria. Spend a little time, go through the Rishonim on Parshas Ki Tazria, which the beginning of that parsha talks about childbirth. Isha Ki Tazria, V'yoldo Zachor, when a woman is Mazria and produces a child, the different levels of Tumah and Tara, if she gives birth to a male child versus a female child. The very understanding of how a human being comes to be, how conception takes place, and how a child's formed. we learn in basic biology today. You know, there's the reproductive seed of the man, the reproductive seed of the woman, and it gets fertilized in the body and produces the child in the womb and grows. And we have a pretty solid understanding of embryology. But that's all a product of the 20th century, maybe late 19th, early 20th, and mid 20th century. That was not known at all in the times of the Gemara, in the times of the Rishonim, in terms of the broader world. And for example, the contribution of a man to the makeup of a child was obvious because the man emitted the reproductive seed outside the body, but a woman didn't emit anything outside the body. So what was the woman's contribution to the makeup of a child? So for example, the Gemara says, Shlosha shutfin yesh ba'adam, and Gemara Nida, there's three partners in creation, or procreation, if you will. The husband, the wife, and a Kadosh Baruch Hu. It's really a beautiful passage in the Gemara Nida. But even the Ramban says explicitly in Parshas Ki Tazria, don't think that the woman has a zera. The woman's contribution is dam nida. And there was a debate about exactly what the woman's contribution was, whether the woman had a zera equivalent to the man's zera, or the woman simply contributed the material substance to the fetus, which was also a theory in antiquity. And they thought, for example, it was a very simple observation. When a woman becomes pregnant, she stops menstruating. Where does that 9 months of dam, where does the 9 months of blood go? So they said, well, it must go to the makeup of the child, obviously. So they went ad kidekach to such an extent they would actually weigh the blood for 9 months to see if it was roughly equivalent to the weight of a fetus. So this was a major debate. It wasn't until the 1500s, the 1600s, with somebody more famous for something else, William Harvey, who's more famous for his discovery of the circulation of the blood. But he's one of the first people who postulated that a woman had her own specific zera. And the ovum, as we know it, wasn't even visualized until the 1800s. And there was notions, for example, that the entire human being was contained within the zera of man, within the reproductive seed of the man. It was called the homunculus. And by the way, there were people who thought it would, the entire human being was contained within the zera of the woman. There was a competing, there was a machlokas amongst the scientists. They were called the sperm at that time was called an animalcule. So there were the animalculists who thought the entire human being was within the male seed, and there was the ovists who thought the entire human being was in the female seed. And you find this notion in halachic literature. So, for example, the severity of Ashvasa Zera, of wasting the male reproductive seed, you know, the famous Aruch HaShulchan and others quoted too, that, you know, they quote that the entire human being, the homunculus, is contained within the Zera. So being mashke is destroying the zera is a very severe iser, because you're actually destroying little human beings. It's based on that notion of the homunculus. So these are just a few theories, and as you mentioned, the book itself is much more expansive in terms of developing the different types of theories with a wealth of sources as well. But it's just fascinating to see the evolution of the understanding of these theories. You mentioned, actually, I'll briefly mention there's one chapter on the seven-chambered uterus. There is an anatomical notion which you'll find in some Rishonim on Parshas Ki Tazria. It's mentioned, by the way, in the name of Sifrei HaTeva. It's not always mentioned as a notion of Chazal per se. It's mentioned that the rabbis knew that they had read the contemporary works. And it's quoted that some quote in the name of the Ibn Ezra, who quotes the name in Sefer Teva. You'll find it in Das Kenvi Bali Atosos, that there was this notion that the female womb had seven chambers, three on the right and three on the left. And if a woman conceived from the three chambers on the right, it would be a male child. If she conceived from the three chambers on the left, it would be a female child. And if she conceived from the chamber in the center, it would be a androgynous. Or a tumtum. So that notion, you know, did not exist. That notion was only imagined in the Middle Ages. That notion did not exist before. You won't find that in the Gemara. The Gemara makes no mention of a seven-chambered uterus. And you won't find it in the 1700s, because by the time Vesalius came around, that seven-chambered uterus was disproved. So you'll only find it, you know, in a very short period of time.
So I want to just go back to the first chapter, which you had mentioned in the beginning, rabbinic conception. So, you know, you go through the, as you say, secular sources, then you go through the Jewish sources, just to say the structure of the book a little bit. There are a lot of footnotes. And I will say it's very readable for someone like me. I don't really have, obviously, no medical training, but even a background and understanding in medical topics. Don't really have that great of an understanding, but it is very, you make it very understandable and readable. So this is not something listeners shouldn't think, oh, you need to have, I mean, I didn't feel that way. Like, you need to have a medical background, a medical training to read the book. It's not the case. So just putting that out there. Another thing that you have in here, so although I should just mention also that we said it's not a sefer of medical halacha, but you do have a lot of medical halacha discussion. You do bring it up, especially as it relates to history and what you're trying to show, but you do also discuss a lot of halachic opinions and things like that. So an interesting chapter, one more chapter we should discuss maybe on this part of the book, which is uterine transplantation and the case of the mistaken question, as you call it, which is a very interesting topic.
So that's a reflection of the importance of studying old discussions or previous discussions on medical topics as a way of enlightening even contemporary discussions. And this chapter on the uterus, uterine transplant, the case of mistaken question is one fascinating example. This topic is in a much later part in history, and we find in a source in 1907, we find a very interesting discussion in a Hungarian journal called Vayelaket Yosef. Vayelaket Yosef was one of the premier halachic journals. Many Gedolim at that time wrote in that journal, and there's a question that's posed in there for discussion. It's a query which Rabbi Yaakov Gordon, who's writing from England, says, I heard the following case, and I'm really curious to hear what my fellow Rabbanim have to say about the halachic issues of this case. And what was the case? He said that he had heard of a woman who was infertile and a woman who received a transplant of the entire set of reproductive organs, including the ovaries, the fallopian tubes, the uterus, and the external genitalia. And he asked a number of fascinating halachic questions. Is there an issue of chavalah? Is it wounding for the recipient? Is there an issue of sirus, causing sterilization, harvesting from a donor? Who's the halachic mother of the child? If a person receives a transplant of a set of reproductive organs and produces a child, does the child belong to the donor of the organs? Does the child belong to the recipient of the organs? So, and what's fascinating about this is many poskim wrote on this. This chapter, which spawned, excuse the pun, a whole host of discussions for future, for the next few decades in many different journals and Shalos and Shuvos literature, and was picked up in the 20th century when discussions of surrogate motherhood became relevant, and people were looking for sources about the definition of maternity. And what's interesting about it is most people for generation after generation just assumed that this had no basis in fact whatsoever. There's no way in the world this case could have been realistic because no such transplants were known to have been performed until literally the end of the 20th and beginning of the 21st century. Nothing like this had happened in 1907. So I did some historical research and I found that this case was not based, is not a fictional case, but the facts of the case, the details of the case, in fact, were misunderstood by the questioner, by Rabbi Gordon. And what had actually transpired was the following, and it's a fascinating case, by the way, which even people in the field of ovary transplant and uterus transplant today don't know about this original case. What was the case? The case was a man, a surgeon by the name of Robert Tuttle Morris, who was dealing with the reality in those days that many young, healthy women had their ovaries removed for abdominal pain. Doctors thought if they had abdominal pain, you have to remove the ovary. So many of these young women had their ovaries removed. They were infertile, obviously, because they had no ovaries, and they went into menopause. So what he did is he said, oh, I got a great idea. Why don't I take an ovary from somebody else and transplant it into these people who've had their ovaries removed? And that's exactly what he did in 1906, or 1905, actually. And he himself removed the ovaries of a woman for supposedly medical reasons, went across the hall, took a sliver of a healthy ovary, and brought it back across the room to another operating room and replaced that ovarian tissue into that recipient. And he records in 1906, the only such case before the late 20th century, that this woman that upon whom he performed an ovary transplant gave birth to a healthy child and had return of her menstrual cycle about a year or two later. An absolutely extraordinary case of ovary transplantation. The problem is, this was only a transplantation of a sliver of ovary. It wasn't a transplantation of the entire ovary, the fallopian tubes, the external genitalia, the uterus, all those things which Rabbi Gordon asked. But because he asked the shaila in the way he asked it, all the poskim responded based on what he asked. So what we have now is enshrined in the halachic literature from over a century ago, extensive discussions about transplanting the human uterus, for example. And they asked Shilas about Pidyon HaBen, who's, if there was a Pidyon HaBen with this uterus before and this woman now has a male child. And the sources that they brought for Pidyon HaBen are absolutely fascinating. And is there an issue of Sirus and is there an issue of Chavol, et cetera, et cetera. Fast forward to the late 20th century when for the very first time in history, there actually was a uterus transplantation. And now uterus transplantation has become quite popular across the globe. And you may have you may or may not have heard, Nachi, but probably about 2 months ago, maybe a little longer, the very first Orthodox Jewish woman gave birth to a child after receiving a uterus transplant. And there have only been, you know, 50, less than 100 cases, I think, of uterus transplant across the globe. And one of those is an Orthodox Jewish woman. So there are halachic issues relating to uterus transplant. And fascinatingly, because this Shiloh was asked mistakenly over 100 years ago, we now have a wealth of halachic literature and discussion, which we can use as a basis for our contemporary discussion.
Fascinating. No, I did not know that. So very interesting. Okay, so the second part of the book, Anatomy and Physiology, we already discussed the first kind of two chapters there. Then you have the Anatomy of Prayer, which is interesting. But the next chapter is what I want to discuss because I enjoyed reading it and it's probably a lot of interest to a lot of listeners, which is the Illusive and Elusive Loose Bone. So, and as you mentioned in the beginning, this is how you met your wife, actually, which is an interesting anecdote, interesting story. But the loose bone is something everyone, basically everyone is familiar with, but not as in-depth. You really go into it very in-depth in this chapter.
Yeah, the loose bone, I just spoke at a conference a few days ago, and the topic was organ donation. And someone asked me, you know, what happens to trias amesim? What happens in the times of resurrection? If you give away your heart, you give away your liver, you give away your kidney, how are you going to survive? So I said, you know, according to our Masorah, the body is reconstructed at the time of trias amesim from one indestructible bone, which is known as the etzem sheluz. Or the luz bone. And there's a lot of rich history about what luz means. Luz may be the shape of an almond. There's a city named Luz where people didn't die. They were the makers of treles, obviously all related, but it's an indestructible bone that never dies. And according to the Medrash also, this bone only gets its nutrition from the Malava Malka. This bone, when Adam ate from the Eitz Hadas, was punished with mortality. The mortality did not affect the luz bone. The luz bone, sort of, so to speak, remained immortal. So there are fascinating discussions about the luz bone throughout all of history, including even identifying where it is anatomically. Many people locate it in different places. So it's located in the spine, for example. Some say it's the seventh vertebra. Some say it's in the area of the skull. Some say it's even a small bone in the toes. Some say it's at the very base of the spine. And interestingly, there is an anatomical term for the base of the spine, which is called the sacrum, which is etymologically related to the word sacred. And some say that maybe that's a hint that the luz bone is really in the sacrum. But what's fascinating is that anatomists in the non-Jewish world were aware of this Jewish tradition about this indestructible bone. Vesalius, who we discuss not infrequently in the book, looked for this famous indestructible bone. He was dismissive. So there is no such thing as a indestructible bone, but there are accounts in history of people who burned bodies for a living and found that there were certain bones that never burned. And in the crematoria of the Holocaust, the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, the horrors of the Holocaust, there are people who said in the crematoria there were small bones that did not burn even in the greatest heats of the crematoria. But one of the remarkable interpretations, I think, is by Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan, who really brings it into the modern era. And he says that the modern, and keep in mind, he was writing before cloning became possible. But he said the modern understanding of the luz bone really is a molecule of DNA. That all we need, all HaKadosh Baruch Hu needs, of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't need assistance, but if we human beings can reconstruct an entire human being out of a molecule of DNA through a cloning process, although no human being yet has been born through cloning, but at least in theory, then obviously HaKadosh Baruch Hu, can recreate the entire human being just from this one molecule of DNA. And the molecule of DNA is indestructible. So you can't destroy a molecule of DNA. You can denature it, but the actual molecular elements you cannot destroy from the face of the earth, no matter how much heat you apply.
Fascinating. You mentioned in Hero Story that Paul Brock gave a, it was a Rav in Kasha in Hungary, and he gave a speech like this. He said he read it in a paper, like what you said, there was in a crematorium.
Right, in the Hungarian paper.
Going around, and he said he found there was just, you know, the person there said, oh, there's all these bones. He went around and collecting. So that's an interesting chapter. You also mentioned, I'm just, you know, once we're going through it, I may as well mention some of the titles. Like, two heads really better than one head. Halachic issues relating to conjoined twins and a two-headed person. Then you mentioned the case of innate heat, which we kind of mentioned the Ramban already. You discussed that. The next, then you get to the next section, which is diseases and therapeutics. So the first chapter is really interesting. The impact of medieval medicine on medical halacha, the case of mumia, which is what is mumia? Tell the listeners about that. That was really interesting. I enjoyed reading that chapter quite a bit.
So mumia is, as you might hear in the very term, is related to mummies. Now, how is it related to mummies? So back in antiquity, there was a substance, a medicinal substance, which was pitch black, which was a mineral substance, mined in the Mideast, mined in the areas around the Dead Sea, which was thought to have great medicinal value. People would rub it on their skin. They'd ingest it orally. They thought it was a real panacea for a number of different medical conditions. It was thought to have such great medicinal value that the Egyptians co-opted this material to use in the embalming process. And that is why, for those of you who've had an opportunity to see unraveled mummies, and you can find some mummies in the museums across the world, in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, in the British Museum, in Northern Italy, in Turin, and of course, for those of you who've been to Egypt, you'll find in the Egyptian museums as well. But the mummies are black. And what happened is there was a transference of the medicinal value of this asphalt black tarry substance from the mineral itself to the bodies which were embalmed with the mineral, such that by the Middle Ages, 14, 1500s, there was a belief that the medicinal value was in the body of the embalmed mummy. And people used to harvest mummies from ancient Egypt and extract pieces of ancient Egyptian mummies and use them for medicinal purposes. And this was called mumia. And by the way, the term mummy is etymologically related to this mumia. It's the same root. And in this time period, the Jews were involved not only in using mumia, because they lived in Egypt at that time where it was largely used, but they were involved in trading in the substance as well. And there's a tshuva which was presented to the Radbaz, or David ben Zimra, who lived in the 1500s in Egypt and was probably considered the chief rabbi of Egypt at that time. And he was asked about the halachic permissibility of using this substance. It comes from a mace. It comes from a corpse. How can you ingest something that comes from a corpse? So he actually discussed with the pharmacists how this substance was mined, how it was produced, what happens from the time that it's taken from the ancient Egyptian mummy until the time that it reached the pharmacist's shelf. It's mixed with many substances. So he was matir based on his understanding of the processing of mumia. He thought the medicinal aspect may not be actually the bus or a mace, the flesh of the corpse itself, may actually be the substances they were using. But in any case, he said, this is the shaloki derech hanaasa. This is not the normal way of usage of this substance. So it probably would be no prohibition of utilizing this mumia substance, of ingesting the mumia substance or using it as a salve on the skin. But he was concerned about tuma issues. He said, for kohanim, if there's a requisite volume of a mace in this mumia substance, then there would be a concern. And you really are missing a large portion of understanding of the poskim. And there's more than a handful of poskim in that generation that talk about the use of mumia. If you don't really understand what was going on in this mumia substance and how it was produced, you're really missing a lot of the understanding of these tshuvas.
Right. So after this, you go through A Tale of Two Stones in the 18th century, which we already mentioned, kind of, you know, chazer a little bit. Then you have an interesting chapter on the use of anesthesia and circumcision, so using anesthesia by Bris Mila. Then you have lessons from the first halachic analysis of vaccination. So that's kind of always a hot button topic, always an interesting topic. So go through kind of historically. So I think that's worth discussing.
Sure. That's especially obviously today in a post-COVID world where vaccination has come to the fore in all of our discussions in the past few years. It behooves us to appreciate how the post-game dealt with the very first vaccination in all of history. And that was for the treatment of a disease called smallpox. Now, I suspect that that of all the people listening to this podcast, less than a handful, if that many, have actually ever seen a case of smallpox. And the reason that that is because in 1974 was the very last case ever seen in the Western world of a case of smallpox. And what happened? Smallpox in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s is responsible for killing over 300 million people. Today, it doesn't kill one person, not one. Zero people are killed from smallpox. Why is that? Because of vaccination. Vaccination, in essence, eradicated smallpox off the face of the earth. But the early days of vaccination, the early treatment before Edward Jenner actually used extracts from smallpox itself. It was called inoculation before the word vaccination came into being, where they would take extracts from people who had smallpox, live active smallpox, and they'd inject them into other people. They'd either rub them in their hands or they'd make a small incision. And as far as the thought was that if a person received a small inoculation of smallpox when they were healthy, they would contract a mild form of the disease and not contract a fatal form of the disease. And the truth is, it worked that way most of the time. But some people contracted a fatal form. Some people actually died, small percentage. But even this, before the so-called vaccination of Edward Jenner, which we'll get to in just a moment, which had a fairly high mortality, the post scheme thought this was better to take these inoculations than not to take the inoculations, even with the high fatality, because many, many, many more people would survive. You know, Allah is kama v'kama, even more so today when our vaccinations were one in hundreds of thousands or one in millions of people, if that many are dying over the course of these vaccinations. Would it be mutter or obligated to take these kinds of vaccinations? Edward Jenner's vaccination was a little different because he actually, in his particular case, used cowpox to inject into the human being, which is related to smallpox and cause much less fatalities, much less risk to the individual. But an interesting observation, Achi, that there were anti-vaxxers even back then, and even in the Jewish community, there were anti-vaxxers. And there was a man in England when it was by law required to vaccinate. His name was Mr. Levy, who said, "I refuse to vaccinate because my Jewish law tells me it's forbidden to vaccinate." And he was thrown in jail at that time by the chief prosecutor, who happened to be a Jewish man himself. And he felt guilty throwing him in jail. He was a landsman. So he went to the chief rabbi, I believe it was Rabbi Hertz at that time, if I recall correctly, and he said, "Rabbi, did I do the right thing?" So the guy claimed, by the way, that since it came from an animal that was treif, because the animal was sick with cowpox, he couldn't get the vaccination from Jenner. So the rabbi said that this Mr. Levy is mistaken. He said, "This vaccination has clearly been proven to save lives. It's halachically obligatory to use this vaccination to treat the Jewish community and to save lives." And his religious exemption is unfounded. And that was in the 1800s when you only had one single vaccination. Halacha is kama v'kama today.
So it was Rabbi Herman Adler was the
Herman Adler, yeah,
rabbi. Yeah, and interestingly, so you mentioned there also one of the when you had this inoculation, when you had the Tiferes Yisrael, your Yom HaKabinet, was a fleckless. Was a fleckless Tamna Yehuda, Bishmal Kayan and Madana. Those were all those of
Matthew. Right, right. Extensive discussions about this. Really fascinating discussions.
Yeah. You discuss Ebola, a new disease in ancient tradition. Interesting thing. Then you another chapter, Lehitra Ebola, as you call it. Goodbye, Rubella. Hello, Zika. And then you go to, of course, you were writing this book during, I guess, during COVID, right? You were finishing it. So you have a chapter on COVID, precedented times, rabbinic responses to COVID-19 epidemics throughout the ages. I guess a book on this kind of topic, how could you not include something on COVID?
Right, absolutely.
Even if at this point, maybe everyone is sick of hearing, I've heard all the stuff about COVID, but you have to include something on it.
Yeah, the COVID. The COVID chapter is remarkable in that it's called "Precedented Times" is the title of that chapter, because the word "unprecedented" we've heard ad nauseum over the last 2 years. And what this chapter shows actually is that, in fact, while clearly there are some aspects of this pandemic which are unprecedented, a view of history and history of the Jewish communities facing pandemics in the past reveals that almost every aspect that we have encountered today has been encountered by our predecessors, including, sheltering in a place, including masks, including isolation, including closing shuls, even including the balcony minyanim and social distancing. There are precedents in our history in the way we face pandemics in the past. So you give one example, balcony minyanim is something which every posek weighed in on. You know, is it permissible to have minyan when you're in different places, not connected, not on the same floor? So the Chidah writes that he was asked a shaila. He goes, he had six people in one house and four people in another house. They can't be in the same house with each other. Can they be mitzarev? Can they join together for minyan? So what do you mean they can't? Why don't the four people just walk across the street and join the minyan? So the reason was the four people were in what's called at that time a lazaretto, which is the Italian term for an isolation house. They were quarantined. They couldn't leave by law, and there was police standing outside, and they'd be thrown in, they'd be thrown in jail or worse, even executed if they left the quarantine house. So it's exactly like this. They had to be distanced from each other. So the Chidah actually paskin, in that case, if they could see each other and hear each other, even though they couldn't physically be in the same house with each other, they could be mitzarev, for a minyan.
Yeah, interestingly, Lazaretto, the Lichidah himself, was there when he went to Livorno. He says that's where he wrote Shema Gdolim, whether he actually wrote the whole thing then or he was revising it, but that's when he was in the Lazaretto in quarantine. When he arrived by ship, they would make sure they weren't bringing any diseases into the port. So this
right, fascinating.
Yeah, that happens. So you have a short section, death and resuscitation. The halachic definition of death in light of medical history, the resuscitation of halacha, an animated discussion, and then a matter of life and death, post-mortem cesarean section in Jewish law. So a couple of really interesting things. And then you have two short things at the end. It's almost like an appendix section, right? If I could say it, in medicine and rabbinic literature, you have one biblical and Talmudic medicine and bibliographical essay. So I guess you mentioned earlier, Talmud Rabbi Yaakov Emden wrote on this. You go through just kind of those who wrote on this. I don't know if you want to mention something on it. And then you have a letter from a Torah sage of the 18th century to the faculty of a medical school, the selective deference of Rabbi Yonatan Eibishitz to medical expertise. And this is famous, especially for the heartless chicken, the Tshuva with the Chacham Tzvi, Maus Kahana's new book actually is right, Tanegulet B'Lilev, A Heartless Chicken, where he goes into this and a lot of things about science and the early modern, pre-modern, whatever era. You actually kind of had a discovery about that. So that's really interesting.
Right. So first of all, I'm continually impressed by your breadth of knowledge, Nachi, even in this field, which is a pretty esoteric field. You really know wealth of the literature. So the biblical and Talmudic medicine is not extensively discussed really in this book, but I thought it essential at least to have a bibliographical discussion about because it's obviously part of the spectrum of the relationship of medicine and science and halacha. But that final chapter of Yonatan Eibishitz, yeah, the discovery was an interesting discovery, especially for you, who's had a wealth of discussions about the Emden Eibishitz controversy. I think it's appropriate to mention this tiny little footnote that I add to this very, very expansive literature. One of the theories, and I believe it was espoused, and you may correct me, by Reb Reuven Margolius, who maintained that this all started the Emden Eibishitz controversy started because Rav Yaakov Emden was the son of the Chacham Tzvi, and Rav Yonason Eibishitz attacked his father, the Chacham Tzvi, on the heartless chicken case. So perhaps this was the this what started the whole ball rolling on the decades fight between these two. That theory has largely been discounted by many of the scholars in the field already for a long time. But my little tiny discovery, I think, put the nail in the coffin for that particular theory, because Rav Yonason Eibishitz, when he was talking about this case, he actually wrote a query to the University of Halle medical faculty, which is a very prominent university in Germany, where, by the way, at that time, many, many Jews were attending medical school at the University of Halle at that particular time. So whereas the Chacham Tzvi was completely dismissive of the possibility of having a chicken without a heart, to such an extent that he would passel Edim, who said they didn't see a heart in the chicken, Rav Yonason Eibishitz said, I think it's possible that maybe the chicken was born with something that doesn't look like a heart, but serves the same physiological purpose as a heart. So he sent two questions to this faculty of Halle. Can you tell me, is it possible for a chicken to live without a heart? A, and B, is it possible to have another organ which doesn't look like a heart but can serve the same function? So I figured maybe there's a record of this particular tshuva in the archives of the University of Halle. So I took a long shot and I wrote a letter to the archives. And I'm trying to figure out what's a good time to tell them when the tshuva was written. So I figured the Kresiu Plesiu, where this tshuva appears, is a good time to good period to ask if they found this query in their archives. And literally, you know, less than 5-6 days later, the archivist comes back and he said, you know, I found an exact reference to this tshuva. It says in the archives, responsa of the Jewish community, and it's clearly a reference to the. It doesn't say Rav Yonason Eibishitz's name explicitly, but it's clearly unequivocally a reference to this exact question of Rav Yonason Eibishitz. This talks about slaughter of a chicken. The whole thing is very clear. So what's fascinating is that tshuva in the that responsa in the archives was only written a year or so before Rav Yonason Eibishitz's death. So clearly, you know, this whole debate, this whole discussion, it didn't start many, many decades earlier in terms of his analysis and writing in the Kresiu Plesiu, but happened much, much later in Yonason Eibishitz's life, and could not have been the source and origin of the famous Emden Eibishitz controversy. And Rabbi Lyman, by the way, it points out that Rav Yaakov Emden even agreed with Yonason Eibishitz's interpretation in the Kresiu Plesiu, and he found, if I recall correctly, he found a copy of the Kresiu Plesiu with Rav Yaakov Emden's notes, on that exact tshuva. So that's just a small little footnote. But the whole essay talks about his integration of medical information and how it's inconsistent. Sometimes he accepts medical information, sometimes he doesn't, especially if it's medical information that Chazal had for many centuries.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating chapter, really short and really interesting chapter. So one thing that I forgot to mention before, I want to mention, you talked about Vesalius, if I'm not butchering his name, and how that's what the cover is. So the cover, for those who haven't seen it, there'll be a link in the show's notes to purchase the book. You can see it. Is pretty distinct. There is a skeleton standing on the cover. It's on some sort of, and he's holding a skull. His hand is on a skull. It's kind of on like a tomb or something. I don't know if it's at the table. It's called a tomb with some inscription on it. And then in the background, there's actually text from Mishnayos. So talk a little bit about the cover and why you settled on this cover.
So the cover was a give and take with the publisher. I wanted to have a cover that reflected the relationship of science and medicine and Jewish law, something which was clearly of medical historical importance. This comes from one of the greatest works in the history of medicine, and Vesalius. There was a little hesitancy to put a skeleton on the cover because the aversion people might have to having a skeleton on the cover. I realize also when you write a book called The Anatomy of Jewish Law, it could very well be a book about details of Jewish law and not have anything to do with anatomy per se. I wanted to make it clear that we're talking about literal anatomy here. And the skeleton, the backdrop to the skeleton, is actually a text from Mishnah Olos, an 11th century manuscript from Mishnah Olos. And it's the passage in the Mishnah Olos which has the text of Ramach Evarim, the 248 limbs, which is exactly what the book is about, the literal anatomy of rabbinic literature and Jewish law. And there's also a little hidden on the bottom, there's also a text of that alludes to the definition of death also, that's used in the discussion of the definition of death, and that's about Hutaz Rosho. It talks about decapitation and whether a person is still considered alive if the body moves after decapitation. And another allusion to that is the fact that the hand of this skeleton is actually holding another decapitated skull. So that's a hidden allusion to Hutaz Rosho in the cover as well.
Right, and this comes from Vesalius. That's why the skeleton and the cover. So you mentioned that these were essays that you reworked. So they do reference, and now you have the notes where you reference the other ones throughout, but it's kind of essays in the book. It's not a book that has to be read in order from beginning to end. You can kind of hop around, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. You do not have to read this from the beginning to the end. You can read it in any order you wish. And I actually apologize that there is a little bit of examples where I repeat a little bit of repetition of footnotes and the minimal repetition of the text, so that each essay is self-contained, and you could read each essay independently. There is a lot of cross-referencing amongst all the essays, but you can definitely read them entirely independently.
So as I said earlier, I found without any medical background, understandable and enjoyable. Was that your what you were trying to do, to have just anyone be able to pick this up and read it and understand and enjoy it?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. This was written. The target audience is anyone who has a skeleton. Is the target audience. It was not intended for a medical audience or a very sophisticated halachic audience, although the concepts, the ideas are sophisticated ideas, and the footnotes are very expansive, and the concepts are sophisticated, but the language was meant to be accessible to everybody, and the terminology meant to be accessible to everybody.
Okay, so for those familiar with your writing, I mentioned you write a lot on Sfarim Blog and elsewhere, especially you have a lot of articles on other things. I'm looking at one now, I pulled it up, that I enjoyed, An Illustrated Life of an Illustrious Renaissance Jew, Rabbi Dr. Shimshon Morporgo, was the Rav in Ancona, Shuvah Shemesh Tzedakah, which should be redone, by the way, I have no idea why it's not. And you have a lot of other type thing where you go through different rabbanim who are doctors or diplomas from the university, and you have very just kind of a historical book almost. That's not in here. Is that something that you're working on? Maybe you want to mention some of those essay articles?
Yeah, so I am working on, this is specifically the relationship of halachic rabbinic literature and the history of medicine. I am working on a lot of just general Jewish medical history. I actually recently published a book with Shaiki Press called Pondering Pre-Moderna Pandemics in Jewish History, or Pre-Modern with the A in parentheses, Pre-Moderna Pandemics, with Shaiki Press, which is historical essays on pandemics. And also I've written quite a bit, as you point out, on Jews and medicine, in particular related to the University of Padua. Where many, it was the very first university where Jews were allowed to attend as medical students. And it opened up really in the 1400s, but became the destination in the 1500s through the early 1800s. So I identified two major archival items, which I've collected over the years. One is medical diplomas of Jewish students. And for another time, you know, it's fascinating that these diplomas are different than the non-Jewish student diplomas. There were accommodations for them, which were unique, and poems, which were written in honor of Jewish medical graduates of the University of Padua. Poetry was very common in Renaissance Italy. They wrote poems for literally every event, but this one event, the graduation of Jewish students from the University of Padua Medical School, merited its own genre of poetry, and I've identified so far 100 poems written for Jewish medical graduates, of which over 90 of them are extant. So it's quite fascinating.
So is that something that you're working on compiling into a book now? Are you working on something else?
Hopefully there will be a book just on the diplomas and poems, and a separate book on the training of the Jewish medical student throughout the centuries and personalities of Jewish physicians throughout the centuries as well, Mirtz Hashem.
Okay. So first of all, I'll link to this book, of course, in the show's notes. I'll link to the Chaiki Press book as well. And thank you for joining me. I hopefully we didn't discuss too much medicine for the average listener, too much medicinal discussion.
Thank you so much, Nachi. This is a real pleasure to join you.